Welcome to Coaching Uncaged, the podcast that pushes the boundaries of the coaching profession with cutting-edge practitioners, authors, and thought leaders. Coaching Uncaged brings you pioneering thinking to enrich the art and science of coaching in all its forms. And now, introducing your host, Robert Stevenson.
Welcome to Coaching Uncaged, another conversation with myself, Robert Stevenson. Today, I will be talking with Dr. David Drake, the founder of Narrative Coaching. I'm really excited to be having this conversation. I studied with David about 4 or 5 years ago now, and so it's a real privilege and honor to be having this conversation. So, David, it's great to have you on the call today.
Thank you, Robert. It's good to see you again.
So as the founder of Narrative Coaching, it'd be great to hear a little bit about sort of maybe where that sort of came from, or what were the instigators for the creation of Narrative Coaching?
Well, it in large part grew out of my PhD dissertation in about 2000 or so. And it was really, I was fascinated by this question of, could you trace the development of our clients' development, that arc, through changes in the stories that they were telling and how they would describe and identify themselves as leader. And the answer was yes. And so I began to really look at what is the hidden potential in the actual stories that our clients sort of innocently tell us, and came to sort of discover that these stories have so many layers and often come from many aspects of ourself, including our unconscious, and include both openings or clues to what the person wants to work on, but also the resolution. And so I began to build a body of work around it in the coaching space, which I already had been working in for about 5 years at that point. And I think that the second sort of major influence was, at the time, I found most coaching was a very sort of simplistic, John Whitmore's GROW model was rampant. A lot of goal orientation, a lot of what seemed like a lot of activity by the coach trying to get somebody into their coaching process. And I realized that that's not really how humans develop, and it's not really how stories form. And so I began to realize that what if we sort of inverted that, and instead of like trying to drive a coaching process, we came alongside a process people were already in, and their stories are trying to tell and retell and reform. And so it kind of, it just shifted the paradigm and the sort of power dynamic in coaching to really be truly client-centered.
I love that idea of sort of allowing the story to do the work. I trained as an actor originally. Mm. So there's something really rich for me about what is this story that's presenting itself as we're doing the coaching, and how can we really tune into the elements that are already there before we even get into what's the goal that we want to create. It's like, how is this person showing up in the first place?
Well, it's often quite surprising when I used to do a lot of demonstrations, and people would say, like, how did you know all that? And I said, it was right there in the story. And they said, I didn't hear that in the story, because again, we're not trained to listen this way. And I would imagine as an actor, a lot of what you're doing is really sensing into what's happening with the other actors, with the scene, what the characters are wanting, what's trying to happen here. And again, sometimes coaches, not so much anymore as coaching matures, but we're worried about how am I doing, and how I'm doing, is an important question, but not really the fundamental question. It's what more of, how's the story doing? What is the story trying to get our attention around? And how's this human in front of us doing with all that? And what's our next step with them?
I think that there's a real interesting piece there about, what's trying to catch our attention. Because often, especially as new coaches, we can be so full of what are we doing, what's our next question, and what's the process that we're going to use, that we sometimes forget that things are being presented to us all of the time. And if we're quiet enough and perceptive enough, we can notice what's being presented and then capture that and kind of look at it and go, let's do some work on what's showing up here, as opposed to just doing my process.
And that creates a really interesting paradox, Robert, because I know when I used to do a lot of work teaching coaching skills in organizations, early people would say, oh, I just don't have time for stories. Our leaders are too busy or whatever. And I said, well, it may surprise you to learn that actually this works much more quickly than many traditional methods, because we don't spend a lot of time trying to gather lots of information or get all the backstory or have a lot of analytic data. We're just really honing in on what is the crux of this issue. And when I used to do these demonstrations, most of them were 10 minutes or less because we just didn't need a lot of extra stuff. And, you know, going back to your earlier career, you know, and you don't want a lot of extra dialogue in this on the stage or in the screen. It just gets in the way. It clouds everything. And the beauty of great playwright, you know, and screenwriting and whatnot is just really getting in on what is the essential dialogue here, the essential words that, or movements that would really communicate. And the same is true with our coaching, that a lot of our coaches really find a sense of relief, because it actually, this is a harder way to coach because you have to really listen to some new things, but actually ultimately much easier because you're not trying to like steer this giant boat down the river. So,
and I think I remember when I worked with you, and I think I read it also in your book where you talked about that as a coach, you're only speaking when you have something to add.
Yeah.
Not just speaking for the sake of it. And I think that as a new coach, especially, or not necessarily a new coach, if you're nervous or if you're not comfortable with yeah. the silence in that space, sometimes you're pulled into it as opposed to yeah. allowing the space to exist and adding to it when there is something to be added.
Yes, which is unfortunately not as often as we think. So, but, you know, and I think it's, you know, because we're getting paid for our craft, you know, a lot of coaches are, I think, rightfully so, concerned about adding value. But like you said, I think we often add value in ways we don't imagine. And if you think about the memorable conversations of any kind we've had in our past, we may or may not, you know, remember what the person actually said, and often don't, but we never forget how we felt to be in that moment in time, you know, whether asking somebody to marry you, or, you know, being at somebody's passing, or kind of a really heated conflict that found a really beautiful resolution. And so for me, it's like we borrow that famous phrase, as you said, from Ram Dass about speaking only when we can improve on silence. And the silence actually has done well, quite a profound restorative and healing function that we often underappreciate. We often think of silence as what happens when you stop talking, but actually silence is the very ground of all this work. Yeah.
I remember a friend of mine who's a conductor, and he used to say that before we have the great music, we have to have the silence.
Yeah.
And that's that you know, the silence is almost the beginning of the piece of work itself.
Yeah, or even like those rests, you know, in certain bars, you know, where it creates that little, like that pause, and you're, ooh, I wonder what's coming next. And without it, just all the notes kind of crammed together, and then you don't really have very good music.
Yeah. So as I think about this, and I think about our listeners and those watching, I wonder, you know, how would you go about describing narrative coaching to somebody who's perhaps new to coaching?
Yeah, so one of the big distinctions shows up pretty much right away in our a narrative coaching session. So a lot of people are taught, you know, you need to kind of contract with your client in the beginning and get a goal and get something to work on and really, you know, get that really clear up front. And we don't do that at all. We rarely set goals. We really never try to pin a client down in the beginning, because the reality is that, frankly, most clients have no idea what they really want. Even if they know something's not working, or maybe they lost their job or something, what they really are able to work on at that moment in time may be not clear to them yet. And so we use a model that's based on a sort of a rite of passage. And the first order of business is really just to witness the human that's in front of us and getting them to situate themselves in this moment in time with us as another human, with themselves and their own story, to pay attention to what actually is. And, you know, we have a lot of respect for people like Timothy Galway, who's been working in that same similar style for a long time, that same sort of be present to what is actually the fundamental starting point, because if you don't have that, the rest is kind of moot. And so it really is unusual for coaches, but once they sort of grasp that, they start to realize the ways in which most of us overexert ourselves as coaches. And usually comes from a lack of trust in ourselves and our process. And when we trust the process and we trust the motion, the moment, and we trust that everything we need is right in front of us, which is our cardinal rule, then all kinds of magical things happen. But the person needs to be in the room first. And so we just welcome them and we honor them and we don't judge them. And then we, something in that story that presents itself will start to create an opening, an invitation to separate from something like, oh, I can see how that story I've been telling myself isn't really serving me anymore. Or I'd like to kind of change how I see myself as a leader. So great, what kind of journey would that involve? And then we're off to dropping into search and kind of exploring what that might look like.
I really like the idea of welcoming somebody into the space and welcoming them as they are. I think sometimes as coaches, we get a little caught in the goal and what we need to create, as opposed to recognizing how somebody's arriving. I've often thought that you've got to deal with what's arriving in the space before you can do anything. What's here? What's with you right now? What's being presented? Looking at that.
Yeah, well, and even in building on that even more, Robert, it's a good point about how, because sometimes if we're not careful, we'll have a sort of an agenda, overt or not, to change the what is. So all my clients really upset, or they're really frustrated, or they're really angry. Oh, I better help them fix that. And what, you know, it's sort of a noble intent at one level, but it's also quite misguided. So it, when we're situating people, what is might include some difficult emotions. And rather than sort of skate by them or try to fix them, which isn't our job, could even be grief. Our job is just to help them be present. So the what is for you right now contains a lot of emotion around grief. So what's that about? What are you grieving? What is the work to be done around grieving? How does the grief support or not support what you're trying to achieve? And so we find that what this does is it creates a much more robust container and possibility for change, because a client's not having to defend himself or herself. They can just be accepted exactly as they are. And then helping to trust, like, oh, this emotion I'm having right now, or this story that's really not working for me, it's there for a reason. It's not showing up accidentally. So I might want to pay attention to it while it's visiting me, while it's here, and learn about how it got to be this way and what I might need to do differently about that.
But when you talk about that accepting somebody as they are, it reminds me of the work of Rogers, where we talk about that unconditional positive regard.
Mm-hmm. And
it's interesting. I've never thought about that when we create the agenda of a goal, which is our agenda, because we sort of go into this idea that that's what coaching is, that it's all about the goal, as opposed to, you know, what does the client want to explore, and it may not be a goal. And when, because I never thought of that as a kind of a steer from my perspective, there's something really interesting about how we are not being unconditional enough in our positive regard sometimes in our coaching. And that's a really interesting thing, I think, for coaches to reflect on, is like, how could you, you know, really delve into that unconditionalness by just going, what is showing up here? Let's accept it and not just do anything with it unless the client chooses to do something with it.
Right. Well, and another piece that I think Carl Rogers is actually quite underappreciated in terms of how much coaching relies on a lot of his early work. But one of his other pieces is that he often was less interested in the content at first and much more interested in the relationship. So like many of us, he started out by, how can I fix this or solve this? And then he realized, oh no, how can I create a relationship that allows the person to either experience something new or work on something that's familiar, but sort of allows them to be stuck. And so in our work, we talk about this, about the energetic field that gets created between you and the client, and sort of holding the space for kind of what's showing up there. And what I find is that, again, it allows people, it's really interesting, it's this blend of compassion and candor. So it's candor, but it's also a bit tangential through the compassion. And what I mean by that is that if you come right at people only with candor, most of us kind of like, whoa, or maybe we might push back against you. And when we work in the space, as opposed to on the content, people can go, oh, wow, that sounds really ridiculous when I hear myself say that now. But it's because it's the words are in the field in the story, not like, oh, I'm ridiculous, or I'm bad for feeling this, or what an idiot I was, but it gives them a bit of a distance to observe their, because their story is them, it's coming from them. And so like, oh, I could see why that person would be pissed off when I said that. I never really thought of it that way. But then they can start like working on it kind of out here. And then our job is to help them to see what they need to see and then begin to bring that back into themselves. But by then they've owned it, they've taken accountability for it, they're more honest about it, and then they can decide then what they're going to do with it. And so,
yeah. I remember the work with you and also reading Michael White's stuff around that, you know, let's externalize the story, let's get it out of here, let's put it in the space. And I know Nick Bolton talks about a withness with a client. So it's not about at, we're working with them at this thing that we've taken out. We then can look at it. And there's something so lovely about looking at yourself, but from an objective perspective.
Yeah.
Notice the kind of the nuance of you before you choose to make change or adaptions or simply just witnessing the self before going, right, that's me and that's how I show up.
Yeah, and then, you know, if there's issues around shame or blame or things like that, then that becomes obvious as well. And so they can be addressed when you're dealing with the story. And we just find it actually is quite moving for people because they can actually see them. It's really hard to look at yourself. You know, it's not easy. And so having that sort of like, oh, wow. Or like, oh, I did a better job there than I realized. I never had thought about it. Oh, okay. And so it's just a nice space to explore with people.
Yeah. And that piece there, you're saying, you know, how key the relationship is and the importance of building upon that relationship. I'm aware that, you know, I know in my early days of coaching, I was rushing to get something done because somebody's paying for me. And I think that's where my value sits.
Right.
And now it's much more about, well, so who are we in this space and how are we going to exist in this? And what does this space mean for us? And what are we bringing here? What are our desires? What are our wants? And let's explore that. But let's also explore who are we, because we can use that. Who are we? What's our relationship? As a play on what the client wants to create or what's happening for the client in the outside world.
Yeah, and so then we can see the ways in which they project onto us. So you see this in a client who, when you ask them difficult questions, their answer is, well, I don't know. And so then I would just say, well, then who does know? Is there somebody I can call that might know for you? And then looking at, there's often an implicit expectation that I would know. Or, you know, what do you think I should do about this? And again, it's like they're trying to form a certain kind of relationship in which you're the one who knows and they get to not know. And then we can begin to explore, you know, how is that pattern familiar to you? Would you like to change that pattern? What would it be like for you if you did know? Are you afraid something's going to happen if you knew? And so again, everything... And one of the beauties of this work is we don't bring in a lot of psychological language. We don't bring a lot of coaching language in. Everything is, for the most part, done using the language in the story itself. The metaphors, the terms, the gestures, the body posture, everything is done with the stories themselves, which again is it drops people's defenses because they're not being analyzed or critiqued or processed. They're just, in their mind, they're just telling stories. And they're like, and there's like this stop all of a sudden, like, oh, I just heard what I just said. And so it makes it more natural, more human. People tend to let their guard down sooner, And so we find it's a very refreshing but powerful approach for our clients.
And I really like what you're saying there about the role that our clients are playing. And, you know, I often think about, you know, what's the character that we're playing, the role that we feel pushed into, as opposed to the role that we actually want. And when we start to identify that, the role that we're playing, we can then make a choice about, well, who do I actually want to be in my story?
Yeah. And it gives them a way to access some of the patterns about how they live their life and relate to other people. And sometimes, you know, we even take on characteristics of certain key people in their life just as a way for them to kind of reactivate the story that sort of sits behind all that. And other times we can play a role in terms of offering a position or a relational position or role that's new for them. Like, you know, and oftentimes they'll say, you know, I've had a number of clients say, there's nobody in my life that listens to me like this. I've never been heard like this. Which I find, you know, it's common but sad. Mm. And I think, again, it goes back to if we really trust the coaching process, which we do, then we believe that there's sort of a self-healing nature to our clients' systems of who they are. And it's really that that relational quality and that sort of sense of being seen and heard that actually is far more powerful than all the much of the talking that we do.
That's really interesting because it sort of points to this idea that there is a quality a coach embodies that creates a space, or is part of creating a space that allows a client to do their self-healing. Mm-hmm. And I think when we kind of take on that stance, it allows us to sort of sit back a little bit from the action that we do as the coach into a more of a, how do I be as a coach in order to create the environment that my client sits in or we sit in that allows them to do that self-healing work without getting into the idea that that healing is a therapeutic healing, but that the kind of the coaching healing work.
Yeah, for me, it's all coaching is therapeutic at some level in the sense that we're dealing with the restoration of the person, not just the achievement of what they're after. But I think, you know, I think it's getting better now that we have more like somatic orientations in coaching and things, but we use what we call serious play, that we want to just see this field as a place for us to work in with objects, with characters, with all kinds of things. And we find that our clients really appreciate that. And what that means for me is that I often am moving my chair. And, you know, a lot of coaches have watched too many movies about therapists who kind of sit back and, well, you know, and do that. And I'm moving in relationship to what I sense the client might want. So maybe they're feeling pretty vulnerable. So I might like just slightly lean in a bit more, create a little bit more intimacy, or say feel a bit safer. Sometimes clients are really need a space to think, or they're really like owning something. Like, oh, I can see what I need to go do now. Then I might like move my chair back, just even slightly, just to symbolically suggest, I believe you can go do this. This is yours now. Go run. And so we believe, and we have I've written a lot of papers about this, but there's a whole series of roles we can play, many of which we'll play many times during a session, always trying to gauge kind of where is this person. And one of our fundamental coaching questions is, what does this person need next? What do they need most right now? And I think, again, one of the mistakes a lot of coaches make is they take on too many things at once. We you know, most of our clients, especially right now in the pandemic, are overwhelmed 24/7. They want one thing they can work on that will have a ripple effect in their life. And we find that when we keep things much simpler, again, our clients' minds kind of settle, they relax a bit. And then when they shift that one piece of their behavior or their mindset, it can then play out in multiple aspects of their life. And we find that can be quite helpful to them. And so a lot of our work is trying to get what we call the crux of the issue clear, because then that, like I said, will help them ripple through many aspects of their life and work.
And that sort of reminds me of the patterns that exist within somebody. Mm. So we find something, we can notice, well, where else is that showing up? So we don't need to do huge work or, you know, lots of different stuff all at the same time. We can just find a simple thing and go, right, where else is that? And then by unpicking that, as you say, there's this whole ripple piece that shows up. And I just want to go back. You talked about the restoration of the person. I just want if you could speak a little bit more about that.
Well, so, you know, one of the sort of academic sort of sources that I use a lot in this work is from Lev Vygotsky, who is a famous Russian child psychologist. And he's most known for his idea of what's called zones of proximal development. And his basic theory for a child, I think, applies to the adult, that we're not interested in testing what they know. We're looking at assessing and supporting what they could know with the right kind of support. And so this idea of scaffolding, so you're taking a child, or in this case, a client, right to the edge of what they can do right now. But if they had some support from you or from others in their environment, they could actually do that next piece. And then as they do that with you, then they can slowly build up internal scaffolding and the ability to do it by themselves. And so this whole piece about restoration of the person is that I don't put a lot of value in aha moments. I don't find them very meaningful. I mean, it can be interesting, but it's really what can this and will this person do about this insight they just had? And so if we don't help them build a foundation and the scaffolding, it doesn't matter how many breakthroughs they have in the session. Because in many ways, I don't measure my sessions. I don't measure the value of my coaching by the sessions hardly at all. Because the sessions ultimately don't mean anything. The sessions are there to accelerate and deepen their capacity to move what's towards meaningful for them. And so it's what they do after the session that is the ultimate measure by how well we've coached them, not how well they felt in the session itself. And so our last phase in our model is called sustain. And we find that we're working more and more to be creative in that space because most coaches are not involved in that phase. Because it's not part of our contracts, it's not part of our thinking or our training, but that's 90% of what creates behavior change is all the stuff they do outside of coaching. And yet we get so enamored with our session. Ooh, I had a great session. Well, it's good. We all should aspire to have great sessions. So, and it's just like, I think it's based on a false understanding of what people actually need from us. They need things they can go do. And we know enough about change that most of it happens when something kind of cracks open, but it's then those small shifts made repeatedly over time. And then they go, oh, wow, look where how I get over here. Wow, look at that. And so we've been exploring how do we do that. And a lot of that has to do with they have to be able to take in what they're discovering in shifting how they see themselves to heal any wounds that will sabotage them or undermine them. So they feel strong and capable to enact what they've discovered in coaching.
I think it's so important for coaches to hear this idea that, yes, what we do in the session is important, but that's not where the work happens.
Right.
The person has to go out and do the work to make the change. And it's also interesting, you know, when I hear coaches say, you know, my client changed, you know, we did some work, we were going to do some more, but when they came back, it already happened. It's like, that's a celebration point because it has to happen out in the world. Otherwise, it won't happen. Because, you know, if it's just happening in the coaching room, well, that's great, but that's a safe space for it to happen. And it's how does this then show up in the world? How does that create behavioral change outside of the space, which is where we can really begin to value or look to value the work that we do.
Yeah. And so we try to give a lot of people a lot of new experiences. So they have a visceral sense of what something might be like, maybe to speak up or play big or play whatever. And then we create lots of experiments so that we don't want to just have an insight and then turn it into a goal that they might do later. Because we say to people that, you know, it doesn't get any better than this in terms of support for what you're trying to do. And if you can't do it with me right now in this coaching session, the odds are pretty small that you're going to do it on your own when you're in the face of the pressure of old stories, familiar patterns, old habits, et cetera. And then we create these small experiments they can do initially back at home or at work. And then we try to do a follow-up session pretty quickly. How do those experiments go? Was it similar to what you did with me? How do you need to fix, you know, correct that, improve on that, build on that? And what we find is it's sometimes not as glamorous as the big sort of emotional, you know, cathartic things in coaching, but clients are so grateful. And so we've gotten to this point in narrative coaching, I've been doing it long enough where we can accelerate that process pretty quickly or in a brief, you know, period of time. But clients are like, one of their biggest things is I will never go back to what I had before. Yeah, I might slip up every now and I won't, and I don't need to be perfect, but we think of it as sort of shifting their narrative DNA. Their whole kind of way of being in the world is changed. And so they're becoming a different person in a way, and or a different part of themselves may be more prominent now. And we find that our clients really appreciate that. And I can't remember the last time I set a goal. It's probably 15 years ago.
It's really interesting you saying about experiments. I remember I gave up drinking for a while. And I never said, I'm giving up drinking. It was, I'm just doing this experiment to see what happens. Yeah. And it takes away all of the pressure of the act, because it's not it's like, this is an experiment. We're playing with this. We're seeing what takes place. That, like you said, that serious play. Let's play with this seriously and see what comes from this. And I'm wondering now, had that phrase come from the work that we've done? Because I also recognize that it's a phrase I used to use with young people when working. Was, well, let's just experiment. Let's play. Let's see what happens. To remove that, if we don't succeed, then we've got it wrong. But it's just an experiment that we're going to tweak and retry. Yeah. There was something you were saying earlier as well about the sort of the taking somebody to the edge that reminded me of the stuff you talk about in terms of thresholds,
right?
In your process and in the models. And I've always really liked this idea that our clients get to the edge of something, and we kind of work with them to get over that edge, in, you know, through that doorway or into that next room or into that next space of being. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the a threshold, you know, literally just means the sill of a doorway. It also has some origins in etymology wise into the threshing grain to separate the wheat from the chaff. But they're in the rites of passage, they're fundamental decision points. One of my early contributions to the literature was to move away from the traditional anthropological model of one primary threshold to create basically four of them. Just because of the nature of how change actually happens. And they're, you know, it's like if you look at the first one, the first threshold is around separation. So I came into coaching, I had this story about why the problems on my team were this one difficult person on my team. It's their fault. That's why our team doesn't work. How do I fix them? How do I get rid of them? And blah, 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 blah. And then through the sort of presence you offer them, they start to realize, there is a small possibility I might be contributing to this problem. So great. So do you have any sense of what that might be? And so they begin to have this dawning awareness of sort of their own leadership style that may be activating less than desirable characteristics in their team. And so you can then create this invitation. Would you be willing to explore what it might be like to let go of that attribute you have, or to really soften that way of leading? And then what happens? And so there's this threshold of, like, as I start to imagine that and feel that, I think, I feel really vulnerable. I use my degrees or my intelligence or my experience at the company as sort of a shield so that nobody questions me, because I'm actually feeling really out of my comfort zone right now because everything's changed so much that I'm afraid of being outed or, you know, caught out, that I'm not really as good as I thought I was. And so I just kind of do this. And so would I be willing to cross a threshold to a place, and it might be like on the other side, you might ask them, so what are you feeling right now? I feel really vulnerable, but it's okay right here. And so what is it you want to say? You might, to your team, you might want to say, I don't know. So what would it take for you to be able to say, I don't know, or I'm afraid too, or we're all in this together in a way I didn't appreciate. What would that be like to say that to your team? Oh, I'm not ready for that. So what would you be ready to say? And so it's this really, it's a choice point, not only in terms of an action or something. It's in terms of a letting go of one identity or one narrative they had to open up the possibility of a next one. One of my favorite ones from my book is about, just a quick headline is, this woman was the youngest in her family, first at everything, always the, you know, small. And through a sort of a tragedy in the organization, she was being called to step up and to fill the departed CEO's role, and she didn't want to go. But every story she was telling me in the session kept saying she actually had this in her, but she couldn't see herself. Mm-hmm. And there was a ritual in her family of origin around serving tea to young women when they were sort of welcomed into the community of women. So they go from girl to woman. That was their rite of passage. That you knew when you went to the elder woman's house for tea as a girl, that it was time that for you to be blessed into that space. And so we're kind of going along, oh, I can't do this. I don't want to do this. And then all of a sudden, as my Aussie friends would say, the penny drops. And there's like this silence. Again, this is a value of silence. I just waited. because you could see like all the ding, 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 ding. It's all like lining up for her. And then she just says, oh, it's my turn to serve tea now, isn't it? I love that story because it's like, and I said, yes, it is. And so that's her threshold. I don't want that. I'm the youngest on the leadership team. I'm the least qualified. But, and so it's ignoring the fact that everybody unanimously wanted her out of all of them to step into this temporary role. And I said, well, but as a leader, as the elder, you get to decide what's best for the organization. That may or may not include you being at the top. When she opted actually not to do, she chose to stay mentoring the leadership team through the crisis. But her own stories were signaling to her what she needed to do, but she was resisting for 40 minutes in our conversation. And then finally, I just kept feeding this back to her, reflecting, mirroring. And so there really is this sense of, you know, really being able to step into her own story across that threshold and say, I am the elder now, not by age or by whatever, but because I've been blessed that way by my own leadership team. And I can't resist that now. I see the call that I've been given.
And as you talk about call and rites of passage, it just, you know, calls Joseph Campbell into the space yeah. and his work. I'm a real fan of his work and the whole kind of monomyth and hero's journey. And I'm just curious how it sort of shows up or transcends into your work.
Well, so it's, so we have sort of four phases that in the model that really are, it's the four phases of change. It also is the four phases of a story. So as people are, you know, presenting one story, but then reformulating to come up with a different story that's going to work better for them. It's the same basic flow for the four acts. It's also the sort of four phases of adult development. And so they're trying to grow again, that platform, that scaffolding to be the person who can enact this over here. One of the things that we're really exploring a lot right now, you know, certainly in this sort of era of, you know, Black Lives Matter, looking at different cultural norms around rites of passage, certainly a lot of the increasing rise of women, and I think a really exciting opportunity for a more balanced view of what leadership means, and a more, you just see the countries that are led by women tend to be faring better than the ones by blokes in many ways. So with that, there's been a sort of a growing critique of developmentally in the rite of passage that that it really is quite masculine in nature. The sort of even the notion of separation, which is a different experience developmentally for a girl than for a boy. And so I think there's a really interesting thing on the near horizon to begin to rewrite parts of that from a feminine perspective. We already have a fair bit of that in narrative coaching because we focus a lot on the relationship, not on the solo journey of the hero, or even to call it a heroine misses the point because there's developmentally different paths that, in terms of a feminine approach to development, which is found in both men and women. And so I think right now what we're seeing like in the pandemic and the climate crisis and the inequality crisis is this need to reimagine the collective, which is very much of a more of a feminine approach, which I think is long overdue in a way. And we have that as men and as in the masculine, but just differently, I think, sometimes. And so I think one of the beauties all along in narrative coaching has been we've never we've seen this as a function of a more traditional Western individualistic psychology. If it's you and your own development by yourself and either succeed or fail by yourself. And it doesn't work, life doesn't work like that. And especially now we see this in my own country, this sort of rampant individualism is wreaking havoc with the pandemic because people, we don't have a culture amongst many in my own country where people are willing to sacrifice some for the greater good. And it's all about me, me, me. And which is exactly the opposite of what we need right now. So I think it's a really interesting question. I think it's going to be, I think the rites of passage remains a cultural a mythology that's very important. And I think it will change in these coming years relative to the environment as well as to the broader humanity.
I think it's something really interesting and beautiful to kind of be talking about narratives and rights and the rewriting of narratives and the rewriting of our rites of passage to kind of embody the place that we are in now as opposed to where we once were. I think there's something really lovely about that.
Yeah.
So as we sort of draw towards the end of our conversation, mm-hmm. Dave, I'm just curious about sort of where do you see your work moving to next?
Yeah, so we've just launched some new programs on what we call integrative development. So ID was a body of work I have used informally to guide my practice, both in organizational projects and in coaching for 20 years. A lot of the really innovative projects we've done have been based on this, but I've never really taken the time to write about it. So we're working on a book, and it's basically it started out being a body of work that brought adult learning and development and organizational learning and development into one practice. So bringing coaching, training, and OD into one profession. Because we realized that so often we were trying to send changed people back into unchanged environments. And a lot of, our schools are broken. Our whole notion of education is just completely wrong, to me anyways, right now. And it allows us to bring sort of four pillars of our own development around our personal development, our spiritual development, our professional development, and our social development into one practice. Because our clients are demanding this because their needs are complex. We need to be able to rise to that occasion to really support that kind of level of work. And there's a sort of a pedagogy that sits behind this that's really counter to many of the more mechanistic, capitalistic ways in which the West constructs things like education. So like for me, I haven't done a traditional training program for probably 6 years, and I won't do them ever again because the data shows they don't work for the most part, and yet we keep doing them. And so we're creating, based on some of my early projects and now the theory we put together, and then we have two new programs that just started, which have been really well received. That people want to harvest what they've learned over their career and their life. They want to integrate it into more coherent practice. They want to work at more levels for their client all at once. They're not siloed and you only get to do OD or you only get to do coaching. And we don't have time to be so parochial and entrenched in our own silo. The needs that we're facing as a society, as a planet, and are just fundamentally calling us to think differently. And so I realized that there really is no body of work to help us do that. So I thought I'll go develop one. So I did. And I've been working on this for a long time, and it's really exciting now to be able to put it together. And I'm back tomorrow and Thursday, we have our next sessions for our big program. And so it's good.
Sounds really interesting and exciting. And it sort of reminds me that as program developers or creators, there is a need for us to push the boundaries of those programs.
Yep.
Because as you say, people are coming from complex environments, and you can't do something that's siloed and not connected to that complexity and expect it to create change. I know that years ago, and I used to work with the Prince's Trust, and we used to take young people out of challenging environments, take them away for a week, do some work with them. It's mainly around drama sort of practice. But the challenge was we were taking them back to that environment, and the environment hasn't changed.
It always wins.
So it's like we've got to change all of it. It all needs to go through that change process in order for change to occur.
Yeah, so it's built on the same principles and practices as narrative coaching. It just basically takes all that we were doing in narrative coaching, but allows you to work at any scale. So I've used it to help a CEO of a big bank reframe the vision for the bank. I've used it all the way down to individual moments in time. And because it's just a way now of seeing the world and being in the world as a practitioner. So we're this week starting our first cohort of integrative development practitioners to train them to begin to work this way, and then to be able to pull together their own unique integration, because they'll have, like you, they'll have different backgrounds. But then think about what does that mean if I brought them together in some more integrated fashion in terms of how I might serve my clients differently.
Yeah. David, it's been a real pleasure talking with you. I could talk all day. For people that are listening, would like to get hold of you, where's the best place for them to find you?
Yeah, so our new website's at www.themomentinstitute.com, all one word, and you can see where we're up to. We've got some really exciting things. We're actually going to take a lot of some certain aspects of our narrative coaching work and create a narrative healing program as well next year to work on things like attachment theory and trauma and shadow, to kind of deal with some of the tougher issues that we're facing. And we realize that a lot of our clients are coming to us for those needs. And there are other resources, but there's some things around in the narrative and coaching space we want to bring to that as well. So, but they can find out about that on our website, and we'd love to hear from them.
I look forward to reading that myself. David, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the call today.
It's delightful to see you again, Robert. Yeah, take care.
Take care. Thank you.
Bye.
If you'd like to watch these episodes as well as listen, you can find the video interviews on our YouTube channel and website now. Thanks for tuning in to Coaching Uncaged. Join us again for more captivating conversations, exploring the art of coaching.